Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Mary Beth Norton. Norton is an award-winning historian and author. She received her PhD from Harvard University and is currently the Mary Donlan Alger Professor of American History at Cornell University. She is the author of many groundbreaking books on early American history, including Liberty's Daughters, The Revolutionary Experience of American Women, 1750 to 1800, and In the Devil's Snare, The Salem Witchcraft Crisis of 1692. Her 1997 book, Founding Mothers and Fathers, Gendered Power and the Forming of American Society, was a finalist for a Pulitzer Prize. Norton is also co-author of a leading history text called A People and a Nation. Welcome to the show.
I'm glad to be here, Tish.
Now, I want to begin by talking a bit about what it was that prompted you to get interested in history as a career.
I was always interested in history as a child. My family used to travel a lot around the country. My dad was an academic, although not a historian, and we would go on summer vacations. We would travel to historic sites, and I think that's what got me interested in it. And also reading a lot of historical fiction. I read a great deal of juvenile historical fiction when I was a kid.
Uh-huh. And were you always interested in American history, or did you have to segue?
No, I was always interested in American history, always. But I thought for a long time I was not going to do colonial history. It was not something I was interested in particularly. I was interested in 19th and 20th century American history.
So what made you decide to segue into
that? I had
that?
A conversion experience when I was a graduate student. I was doing a seminar paper for a course in colonial America, which was the first course I ever had in it. I never took a course in it when I was an undergraduate. And I was doing a seminar paper on the Stamp Act crisis of 1765. And I was reading a pamphlet by James Otis. And it was as though James Otis reached out through the years and said to me, "Why have you not paid any attention to the 18th century before?" So after that, ever since I've been a colonial historian.
Well, in the 70s, you began researching on women specifically. Well, what made you decide to go into that arena?
That was really the feminist movement. When I was in graduate school in the 1960s, there was no women's history. Nobody even thought about doing women's history. I didn't particularly think about doing women's history. But after I started teaching in 1969, my first teaching job was at the University of Connecticut. Mm. And the first articles on American women's history started to come out then. And they were by 19th century historians, and they made assumptions that I thought were incorrect about 18th century women and their lives. I hadn't really worked on women, but what I had done for my dissertation, which was on the loyalists of the American Revolution, I'd read a lot of letters that passed between loyalist husbands and wives. And even though I wasn't focusing on the wives, I was focusing on the husbands, I did have a sense of what the wives' lives were like. And I thought that these articles on 19th century history were incorrect. And so I thought, well, I'll write an article to show people how they're incorrect. Well, 8 years later, I had my book, Liberty's Daughters.
Uh-huh, so that's what prompted you. Well, women have been left out of history. We all know that. All of us who are baby boomers wondered where we all were in the history books.
There was no history. There was no courses in women's history or anything like that when I was in college. Mm-hmm. We never even read things by women.
Well. So were you surprised to when you started delving into this subject to actually find so much information that had been overlooked?
Absolutely. When I started when I started to tell people what I was going to do, I was going to do a book on women in the era of the American Revolution. Everyone said, "You're not going to find enough sources." And not only did I find enough sources, I found references to all kinds of collections of papers I didn't even have a chance to ever go look at. But in the end, I looked at more than 450 collections of family papers and women's diaries and so forth from the revolutionary period. So there was plenty of material.
So this really is a matter of all these male historians, specifically male historians, mm-hmm. forgot to ask the right questions.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah. And even actually earlier female historians too, because of course women in graduate school in the 50s and 60s and before were trained like the men. That is, that women's stuff, the material about women was unimportant,
mm-hmm.
and
they
it
were
was
just
not
sitting
the,
around
was
setting
not the
table
most important thing
while the
right.
men were making history.
Yeah,
what was
exactly.
the thing that we all
exactly
all hearing during that era? Now, your book Liberty's Daughters, which you did mention that came out in 1980, mm-hmm. it explored the lives of women before and after the Revolution. And one of your premises is that women's lives really did change considerably after the revolution. Talk to us a little bit about this.
Well, actually, I mean, they changed and they didn't change. Mm-hmm. I mean, parts of women's lives changed and parts of women's lives didn't change. I argue that the experience of living through the war and the experience of participating in the wartime resistance movement or in the resistance to the British before the war gave women a new outlook on their lives. That is, before the war, they would write in their letters that politics were not their sphere. This is the kind of phrase that they used. I know, or I should say, nothing of politics, they would say in their letters, because that's for men to deal with. Mm. But then during the war, they kind of got mad at the men when they thought the men were not doing things properly. And they also saw a public role for themselves, certainly in things like boycotting tea and boycotting British manufacturers, because they were the ones who tended to drink the tea and they were the ones who tended to buy the clothes. And so as a result, they saw themselves having a public role. Mm-hmm. And I argue in the book that they then had a different attitude toward themselves after the war, even though the laws didn't change. People who'd written about women and the revolution previously, though there weren't very many of them, had said, well, nothing happened because laws involving women didn't change after the war. Women didn't get the vote, all kinds of things like that. But I said what really did happen was women's attitudes changed, and their attitudes toward themselves, what they were capable of. One of the things I discovered, of course, was that when men were gone for long periods of time during the war, women took over the farms. Mm. And one of the really interesting things I discovered is changes of pronouns in letters. John Adams and Abigail was a classic example. When John leaves first, Abigail wrote him letters saying, your farming business this or your farming business that. Later in the war, it became our farming business. Ah. By the end of the war, it was her farming business.
That's great. You actually delved intimately into women's lives that had never happened before. You read diaries, letters. To tell us a little something about the intimate life of these women.
Well, it was very interesting to read these individual letters and to build up a view of what women's lives were like. I mean, for one example, I discovered that although on the one hand they very much wanted and loved children, on the other hand they were desperately afraid of childbirth because they knew, everybody knew women who had died in childbirth. And so they were on the one hand delighted that they were going to have babies and on the other hand very much afraid that they would die. And it was when I would read the letters in a family, of course, I wouldn't know how the story came out because I would be reading along and living the lives of the families the way the families themselves were living them. And sometimes I discovered that the women I was most involved with died in childbirth. Mm. And one woman in particular, I remember, she was very fearful. She had two or three difficult pregnancies, and she said, I hope that I may survive the next one, and then she didn't.
That happens.
It was very
often.
Sad, yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, we don't think about the intimate lives of women. We just think that they're, you know, serving tea and doing nothing other than
that. And one of the diaries that I was most affected by was a Virginia woman who kept a book of instructions. She started writing down everything she knew. She was certain she was going to die in childbirth. And so she thought, I'm going to write everything down that I know so that my daughter, she was convinced she would have a daughter. She was convinced she would die in childbirth. I will write everything down that I know so that my daughter will have it after my death. Mm. In the end, she never actually gave birth to a child that lived for very long. But she had written all these directions, and it was so sad because she said, at one point it was as though she was speaking to me over the years. She said, whoever is reading this, don't laugh at me. Don't recognize how serious I am about what I'm saying here. And I have this book beside me. I'm feeling very ill. I don't know what I'm going to do with it. Maybe I'll give it to my friend who's coming to see me. And I think that's what happened because the book ended up in a manuscript library. I think it was given by the family, I think, of the friend who came to see her on her deathbed.
Wow, she literally was writing across the ages.
Exactly.
For your
it
eyes.
Was really, it was as though she was speaking to me directly. Mm. It was really something very moving when I read that.
Oh, I can imagine. Now, I also want to talk about your book, Founding Mothers and Fathers, Gendered Power and the Forming of American Society. Mm-hmm. How did you choose the term gendered power? That hadn't been used in a history book before.
It had not, no, but I was interested in how power and gender were intertwined in that book. And that book is about the 17th century. It's it's about the settlement of the colonies. And it's really about how in the early years of the 17th century colonies, there were powerful women who, because they were high status, were able to wield authority in the colonies. And when people would ask me at that time what I was working on, I would say, well, I'm trying to explain Anne Hutchinson. Because Anne Hutchinson, of course, split the colony of Massachusetts Bay right down the middle in the 1630s and almost caused a major, I mean, really caused the colony practically to collapse because it divided so much. She was such a powerful figure, and she's always been regarded strictly as a charismatic religious figure, and she was that. But I thought to myself, there has to be another reason why people followed her, and the reason is that she was a woman of high status, and this is a time in which high-status people of either sex were deferred to by low-status people. And she got her followers not simply because of her religious ideas and because of her own personal charisma, but also because people knew they were supposed to listen to her. She had the standing that meant that people had to pay attention to what she said.
And what was her agenda?
It was not her. Her agenda was strictly what she wanted to do was to bring what she thought the true meaning of Puritanism to the colony. And it was not the meaning of Puritanism that the Orthodox Puritans in charge of the colony accepted.
Uh-huh.
And in particular, what she believed was that God spoke to her directly, that God gave her direct revelations. And that was very anathema to the leaders of Massachusetts Bay, uh-huh. that anyone other than a minister, perhaps, would have the right to have God speak to them. So that was what was so dangerous as far as they were concerned.
Mm-hmm.
Also, of course, if the lay people in the colony could speak directly to God or God would speak directly to them, they wouldn't have to pay attention to the ministers. So the ministers were not too happy about that argument.
A little power play.
A little power play, yes.
So this book also talks about the first settlers and how they define power and roles.
Yes, that's right.
Was it changing during that time?
Well, actually, that book is really about a static period. It's not a period in which it changes. The whole point of that book was to describe a pattern that later changed, and to describe particularly this pattern in which there were the ability of women to be powerful. I mean, another classic example from that book is Margaret Brent, who was a gentlewoman who basically ran the finances of the colony of Maryland for 18 months.
Mm.
And by modern standards, by 18th century standards even, that's crazy. Why would you ask a woman to do that? Was it because she was one of the few people of gentle, what they would say, gentle birth? That is, she was one of the few gentry settlers of that colony. And so, therefore, she was someone they could turn to in a moment of crisis. They had a tremendous moment of crisis. And it was in the aftermath of a civil war in the colony. And they turned to her to run the colony's finances, which she did very ably for 18 months until she was replaced by the Lord Proprietor of Maryland.
Isn't that amazing that all this history was overlooked for so many years?
Yeah, it is. I mean, Margaret Brent has come down in history because she actually went to the Assembly of Maryland and she asked for the vote. And so in popular histories of women's suffrage in America, she's often the first chapter or the first page. Margaret Brent goes and asks for the vote. But what people haven't questioned, and which I questioned and tried to answer, was, well, why did she think she had the right to the vote? Why would she do that? And it was basically because she was the chief financial officer of the colony, and she said, hey, if I'm the chief financial officer of the colony, I ought to have the right to vote.
And I ought to have a say.
Yeah, exactly.
How things move forward. Wow, interesting. Now, I don't want us to run out of time because this is very fascinating to almost all of us. Your book about the Salem witch trials. No one ever gets enough of this.
No.
The book's called In the Devil's Snare, The Salem Witchcraft Crisis of 1692. Now, you kind of came across a new thesis about why all this transpired. Talk to us about it.
Well, when I started working on Salem, I didn't expect to be coming up with a new thesis. I was drawn to it by my own research and by what I read in the documentation. And basically what I realized as I read not just the trial records, which is what most people had read, but what I did was to read a lot of documents around the trial records. I looked for correspondence by people at the time. What I really thought I was looking for was comments on the trials by people at the time. I thought, well, I'll find out what ordinary Massachusetts residents or ordinary New York residents thought about the Salem witch trials while they were going on. And I found a bunch of correspondence, but hardly any of them talked about the witch trials. And I thought, well, this is peculiar. Why aren't they doing it? But what I discovered they were talking about was the Indian Wars. And I thought, well, that's interesting. So I started to investigate the Indian Wars. And I realized when I looked at the records of the Indian War in the Maine and New Hampshire frontier, at that time that many of the people who had been living in Maine in the 1680s were fighting with each other in the Salem courtrooms in 1692. And it was the names just leapt out at me from the pages of these records from the Indian Wars and from the various letters that I read. And so I began to realize that there was much more attention to the Indian Wars than I needed to pay much more attention to the Indian Wars than anyone ever had.
If you're just joining us, my guest is historian Mary Beth Norton. We're discussing her book at the moment, In the Devil's Snare, The Salem Witchcraft Crisis of 1692. Continue on that line of
thought.
Yes,
well, basically, I'd read all the books about Salem witchcraft, and there have been many, many, many books about Salem witchcraft. And those books usually have a chapter which is called Background Factors. And in that chapter, one of the background factors, there's a number of background factors, one of them usually is the Indian War that was going on to the north. But what I realized when I was doing my research was that the Indian War permeated the records in serious ways. People would report to the court having nightmares of Indians. People recorded to the court having visions of Indians. People, the key accusers were people who themselves had been through the trauma of Indian attacks. We all know about the afflicted girls or the hysterical girls who are the accusers, the key accusers in Salem witchcraft. Well, a number of them were refugees from the Maine frontiers. Their families had been wiped out by the Indian Wars, and I was fortunate, because the records are very spotty, I was fortunate to be able to place three different ones of them at specific traumatic experiences while they were young children. In one case, at the age of three, one of the later accusers saw her uncle die horribly from an arrow wound in front of her eyes. Another was the granddaughter of one of the wealthiest men in Maine and was besieged with a bunch of other people in a house, and they thought the Indians were going to be able to burn it down. And just by chance, the fire went out, so they didn't roast alive in this house.
Wow.
I mean, can you imagine if you're 11 years old and that happens to you, and then you later on are a servant girl in Salem Village, Massachusetts, because your whole family fortune has been wiped out and you have to support yourself somehow. And then people start talking about the Indians again. And what happens? You start to have fits. I mean, today we would say these girls were suffering from post-traumatic stress.
I was just going to bring that up. That was one of the conclusions you came up with.
Yeah.
And you still think that might be part
I
of
think
it.
So.
A lot
I
of people
really
thought
do.
They were on hallucinogens.
Yeah.
Did you totally eradicate that idea?
Well,
as
I think I did. There's still people who argue for it. But the problem with saying that they're on hallucinogens of some sort is that even if that explains the hallucinations, that they're having hallucinations, it doesn't explain the content of the hallucinations. Mm-hmm. I mean, even if they're taking some version of LSD or they're doing something else like that, it may give them hallucinations, but it's the content that I'm interested in. It's the content. When they see diabolical Indians, it's the content when one of them sees this minister from the Maine frontier who was previously the minister in Salem Village. She sees him as the leader of the witches, and she sees him bewitching the troops who are trying to fight the Indians on the Maine frontier. There's nothing about any particular hallucinogen that would force her to have that particular vision.
Mm-hmm.
So I would argue that whether they're on hallucinogens or something is practically irrelevant, because what's important is what they're seeing, not the fact that they're seeing it in a lot of ways.
And how did you account at the end of this book for the fact that some of them did bleed and have tooth marks?
I just don't really account for that. I sort of say I'm an agnostic on that sort of material. Actually, some of them have pins stuck into their flesh.
Mm-hmm.
It is, of course, we know people today who cut themselves and so forth and may do so in a kind of a trance-like state. So later on, they can look at it and say, I didn't do that, but yet you know they did it. And so that kind of thing can happen. I mean, I'm not someone who tries to explain everything about the psychology of 17th century people by any means. Just what I think is immediately explicable.
Yeah. And you talk in your book about how different this was, because it permeated so many places and there were so many accusers. And victims.
I mean, most people do call it the Salem witchcraft crisis, as indeed I do. But in fact, there were 144 people accused, and they were from 22 different towns in Massachusetts. And 15 of those towns were in Essex County. Essex County was really the front line of the Indian War. And so it's not just Salem. It's all over the place. And I think one of the things that remains to be done is to look more carefully at some of these other towns, in particular Andover. Andover is a very interesting place. There are actually more accused people in Andover in the end than there are in Salem Village. And it has never really been adequately studied. I know that there is a research project underway now about Andover, and I'm hoping that it will help to explain things. I didn't have the time in my own book to... By the time I realized how interesting Andover was, I just couldn't write another whole book about Andover, so I'm sort of leaving that to somebody else. But it would be very good to have an explanation about Andover, because Andover, the patterns are completely different from in Salem Village. In Salem Village, people accuse their enemies of being witches. In Andover, people accuse their friends of being witches. They accuse their sisters. They accuse their mothers. They accuse their brothers and their fathers. I mean, it's fascinating. You get the people who are themselves... People who are the accusers, they accuse the people with whom they most closely associate on a daily basis of being witches.
See, that just shows you that, that human nature doesn't change. Now we have bad girls,
I don't know about that, but I mean, they just... there's this one particular family of five daughters that are sort of stepsisters and half-sisters and so forth, and they all accuse each other of being witches. Hmm. And they all confess in the end to being witches.
That,
and they all
that,
and they confuse and they accuse their mother and they confess. Yeah.
Oh, that's remarkable. So we need a psychological study of this. Yeah. Now, you did a lot of your research at Cordell, and a lot of people don't know that they have a witchcraft collection.
Huge witchcraft collection. Yes.
That's amazing to me.
Well, you know, it goes back to the origins of the university. Andrew Dixon White and Ezra Cornell believed that one of the best things that happened in the world was the Enlightenment, and they wanted to show what life was like before the Enlightenment, and they wanted a negative example. And so in the late 19th century, every summer, the librarians would go out of Cornell University over to Europe, and they bought all these witchcraft books and records. The Cornell collection has especially a lot of material on the witchcraft in the continent, but it also does a lot of English material and a bit of American material, not much, but mostly it was useful for me for the English material, which is very, very good background for me, because one of the things I wanted to know was how did English people in the 17th century respond when young people accused other people of being witches. I wanted to know what the patterns were. Was it unusual what happened in Salem? And the answer is no, not in that regard. That is, when children or young women would accuse older women or older men of being witches, usually their elders believed them.
Really a fascinating.
They didn't always lead to trials. They might lead to other things like prayer and fasting and things like that. But they did believe them. It was quite believable.
Do you think people are still interested in this case because it's so inexplicable?
I think so. Yes, it seems so. It is bewitching. There is no way. I mean, other way to describe it. I mean, you get stuck by it because there's more than 3,000 names in the records. So I keep running into people who are descendants of Salem witches or descendants of judges or descendants of one of the ministers. I just got a letter the other day from someone who's a descendant of one of the ministers who was a witness in one of the cases. And he said he wasn't sure whether he liked being a descendant of this guy or not.
And you were one of the people they turned to when they were doing Who Do You Think You Are, right? Sarah Jessica Parker?
Yes, when the people who do the show on NBC, Who Do You Think You Are, discovered that Sarah Jessica Parker was a descendant of a Salem witch, I'm the one they came to go and be in Salem and tell her about her witch ancestor. Yes, it was a very interesting experience.
Did you actually look into it to confirm that that's true?
No, it's true. I mean, I didn't do the genealogy. The genealogy was done by the people at the New England Historic Genealogical Society, and those people are indeed very, very reliable. But I knew all about her ancestor. I mean, that's why they came to me, was I already knew about her ancestor. So I was able to give her the details. In fact, I was the one who discovered the document. If anybody who's listening saw that show or wants to watch it on Hulu.com, there's a crucial moment at which I show her the document, which is the accusation of her ancestor. I'm the one who found that document. That document was unknown until I found it in the course of my research.
Wow, that's both good and bad, probably, to Sarah Jessica Parker. Now, history in some ways is a strange discipline. I mean, women and minorities have been left out. It has to do with interpretation, people's politics. Do you think history can ever be definitive?
Oh, history is never definitive. Every generation rewrites history in its own image, as it were. There's no question. Always new questions come up. I mean, it's not surprising that historians in the 60s started asking questions about riots that they'd never asked before. It's not surprising that historians in the 70s, like me, started asking questions about women that had never been asked before. Mm-hmm. It's not surprising today that historians are asking questions about immigrant communities of Asian and Hispanic people in the 19th century that had never been asked before. It just what you, the life you live in your daily life as a historian today really very much affects the kinds of questions you ask about mm-hmm. the past.
And then the main point, as we said earlier, is to ask the questions.
Yes, absolutely. The crucial thing is to ask the right question. I always tell my classes finding the right answer is a lot easier than asking the right question.
Mm-hmm.
Posing
mm-hmm.
the right question is the crucial thing.
Because
once you've done that, then it's usually relatively simple to find the right answer. But if you ask the wrong question, you're up a creek. You can't get anywhere.
Yeah, or if you don't ask the questions at all.
If you don't ask the questions.
What happened in the case of women missing from history.
Right. Well, no, I mean, people ask questions that just didn't include women.
Uh-huh. Or they didn't answer them.
Or they ask questions about, for example, the temperance movement in the 19th century, about how men were reformed or attempted to be reformed by temperance, but not about how women attempted to reform men by temperance.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, do you have an opinion as a historian how much time needs to pass before one should delve into, for instance, like the Bush era? Everybody says it's too soon. How much time do you think?
You do need some perspective. Of course, I'm lucky I have a lot of perspective. And I'm also lucky that nobody I write about can ever challenge me.
Oh, you never know.
Yeah,
the witch trials were in any way through. The specters might come back.
Yes, well, I did. There were moments when I had since spent some sleepless nights when I was working on the witchcraft trials, and I thought, you know, specters were appearing before me. But no, they really can't challenge me. So I've got it easier than people who are writing about people who are still alive.
But other historians can challenge each other in that.
Oh, yes, absolutely, of course. And in fact, I've been challenged by many historians about all my books. But back to your question, I mean, I do think you do need some perspective. It's hard. I mean, journalists do tend to write what they call the rough draft of history, and that's sort of what it is. But you do need a few years. I mean, I've been saying to people for some time that there's going to be a really wonderful dissertation about the attitudes towards Hillary Clinton as First Lady, just a wonderful dissertation. And we may be getting to the point where somebody could write it, but we couldn't do it right after she finished being First Lady. Now that she's Secretary of State, maybe, you know, there's enough of a different attitude. But
it seems to be
there was so much
more time, even.
You know, and now that Michelle Obama is a similar sort of person, an accomplished professional woman, that may also help tend to lend more perspective to Hillary Clinton. But you may remember the tremendous attention to Hillary Clinton as, you know, her hairstyles and her this and her that and her meddling in healthcare and so forth and so on. I mean, it was just, she was clearly a major cultural phenomenon when her husband was president.
One would have thought this should have happened in the 70s instead of the 90s.
Right. Yes, exactly.
Now, we're almost out of time, Mary Beth. What are you working on now?
Well, actually, if you want to know what I'm doing, it's related to something I said earlier. I said earlier that as the revolution approached, I was struck by the letters of women that said, "I shall say nothing of politics because that's not my proper role." I decided I wanted to know where that came from because it wasn't there in the 17th century when I did my book on founding mothers and fathers. And so I decided I wanted to understand whence came the idea and when came the idea that women had no proper function in the public realm. And so that's the book I'm writing now. I'm in the middle of writing it. It should be done, I hope, in the next few months, and it should be out next year. And it's transatlantic because it turns out that the origins of these ideas are English, and then they get picked up by Americans.
Oh, interesting. We will look forward to that. Well, Mary Beth Norton, thank you so much for joining us. Right. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Well, it's been a pleasure.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. If you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation in support of the Out of Bounds radio show, please contact our fiscal sponsor, the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes, at earts.org. That's earts.org. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.